Learn the truth about how your mind really works with author and cognitive scientist Nick Chater. Today we reveal the key insights into AI, human intelligence, and debunk myths about the brain and human behavior. If you want to understand how your mind really works, this episode is for you.
What's a myth about how the brain works that you wish would disappear for good?
Well, this is a big one, really, but it's the idea that we think through our behaviors and plan them in a sort of detailed way. We have our sort of beliefs, sort of objectives, and we kind of plan what we're going to do, and then we slowly and put together our plan and then do it. So that if you ask me, why'd you do that? I should be able to say, well, come on, what was the plan? You know, what did you think was true? What were you aiming to do? You tell me the story, and I'm going to produce that story because I had it in my head beforehand. So the sort of idea that that's kind of rational and sort of detailed and somewhat explicit planning process behind our every word and action. And that when we're asked to explain ourselves, we should be able to produce it. I think that's a tremendous illusion, actually. And instead, we should think of ourselves as a bit more like ChatGPT. So when you ask ChatGPT a question, and then you say, why did you say that? Or is that really right? It'll say something. You'll think, well, it'll produce an answer. But if you were to think, well, hang on, that answer, suppose I asked ChatGPT to do a sum and it gets it wrong. And I say, well, that's not quite right, is it? Why did you make that mistake? It'll say something. Oh, I forgot to carry a 10 or whatever it is. But if I look back into, I couldn't look back, but nobody could. But if I could look back into the vast network of ChatGPTs, underlying computational machinery, which is whatever it is, I can't remember the figures now, but that'll be many, many billions of nodes and connected together in many more billions of connections, and just see all that pattern of activation flowing through. If you're kidding yourself if you think that ChatGPT's actually explaining its error, or indeed its correct answer, by going back and thinking, yes, well, let me just remind myself of the massive, vast flow of activity that went through the system, actually distributed in the case of ChatGPT all across the world and all sorts of different computers. Well, it's not doing that at all. It's thinking, well, something's gone wrong here, and I'm going to treat this just a new question. Okay, yeah, let me produce a plausible answer. And you give me you might say, that's not a very good answer. Okay, I'll give you a new answer. And so it goes on. So it's rationalizing. So ChatGPT is rationalizing. Is not reaching back into its carefully planned and thought through step by step origins of its behavior and its words, and it's just the same for us. The great danger of this, I mean, there's so many, I could go forever about this, but the great danger of this from my own point of view is thinking, I can't understand myself. It's very puzzling. I really ought to be able to explain why I do X, Y, and Z. So either you foolishly think you can, and you come up with stories and you think, well, yeah, that's it, that's what I intended all along, or you feel sort of mystified by yourself, as if this is very strange. How can it be that I did something, but I didn't kind of understand it? Or, for example, if I might choose a particular word, which is, kind of inadvertently upset somebody or something, I might think, oh, what was I doing there? It possibly wasn't, there was no plan. I can have a think about why I did it, and so can you, and everyone can, and we're all guessing. It's just not the right answer to sort of chastise oneself and think, well, if I'm more careful in future, I'll be able to plan everything perfectly carefully and do everything as it were, as I wished. And equally, of course, if you're trying to understand somebody else, the things they do for good or ill, it's wrong to be thinking there's a true story about their real motives, for example, or the thing like what they really thought was going on. We're all a kind of big soup of improvised thoughts, and we're improvising moment to moment. And if you ask me, why did you do your thinking that particular way, I'll improvise a new thought for you. And then another one. And which is not saying that we're entirely inconsistent, but the idea that there's this kind of underlying sort of deep planning machine. I think that's a myth that I think we're going to really struggle to get rid of, because people are always asking each other things like this. They're sort of saying, well, why did you say that? What do you say that for? Or if you think that, presumably you must think this too. As if we've got this kind of fully thought out rational explanation behind all our actions. That's the way we talk. we sort of all know it's wrong. I think that's one of the funny things about it. It's one of these, it's sort of a myth that if we go on as if it's true. But if you ask anybody in detail, you say, let's say you're looking at something like tennis, and Wimbledon's on at the moment, as we're recording. And if you ask a tennis player, why did you come into the net then? They'll say, oh, well, I could see that, that I had a chance to put in a tricky volley or whatever it is, and the person wasn't going to be able to pass me very easily. And they'll tell you a good story about it. But of course, they didn't generate that story in the sort of few hundred milliseconds where they decided to hit the drop shot hit a volley coming to the net or whatever it was. I mean, it's just, we all know it's nonsense. We all know that as we're in the flow of activity, tennis or otherwise, we're just doing and saying things at a rate that we have no way we're able to think any of this stuff through. But I think we sort of all know that it's wrong, but we sort of live with it anyway.
Why do we live with it, and how might we adaptive?
Yeah, it's a good question, really. I think one of the things that is very adaptive, very important, is that we're able to hold each other to account for our actions. So a world in which people just went about saying and doing things, and if you ask them why, they said, well, it's a mystery to me. I mean, my brain's got, 10 to the 11 neurons in it, and so is yours. And, who knows what they're all up to? I mean, that would not be very helpful, because then you wouldn't be able to get people to take responsibility or potentially commit to doing things differently in the future, and so on and so on. So the process of being able to query people and get them to justify their behavior is very important, I think, in making social interactions work. And that process of justification is not irrelevant to our future behavior either. So if I say, oh God, I did it for this reason or whatever, probably it's usually the wrong question to be asking, but say I think, okay, I was too cautious. Maybe I was a tennis player and I'm talking to my coach, and I think, okay, I wasn't coming to the net enough. I was just too cautious. Now that is not the case that there was some hidden state of caution that was lurking within me that could have been identified by an appropriate brain scan or anything like that. That's completely wrong. But it is true that now we've had the chat about being too cautious, so I can think, oh, okay. So now, more aggressive shots or more running into the net or whatever. So I can, in a forward-looking way, having conversations and thoughts about my own behavior and about other people's behavior, can shape the future. So we can we make us accountable for the past, so we can't just walk away from all the things we've done, saying, well, it's just my brain, isn't it? It's nothing to do with me, as it were. We have to be accountable, but also we have to be able to learn in a sort of forward-looking way, in a thoughtful way, to shape our future behavior, which I think we are really very good at doing. So I think the fact that we talk about the things that are running through our minds, and the things that are, and we also talk about the justifications for our actions. That's, I think, that's a very important part of social life. But the illusion is thinking, oh, when I'm explaining my action, I'm telling you about what was going on in my head about half a second ago. That's the illusion.
Yeah, and there's this kind of like graph or picture that I'm sure you've seen about a million times, where it's the iceberg, and it's like 1% or 5% of your mind is the tip of the iceberg, and then like 95% is below, which you're unaware of. Are you saying that the subconscious doesn't exist or is an illusion?
Well, I think the iceberg picture is in some ways deeply right, in some ways deeply wrong. So I think the deeply right way sense is that the calculating activity your brain is doing, all these 10 to the 11, i.e. 100 billion neurons chuntering away, almost none of that is impinging on your consciousness at all. So in some sense, the brain's doing lots of stuff. Most of it I could say nothing about. In fact, I'll say a bit more, something a bit stronger than that. I think the only thing you can ever consciously be aware of, and this is a slightly more unusual position, is essentially the outputs of essentially sensory systems. So I look at the world, about a third of my brain, like everybody else's, is working on understanding the visual world. So I open my eyes and there's a world. Now, if you, so my huge amount of calculations going on to figure that out. But if you then say, okay, why did you conclude that's a cushion in front of you? You think, well, it's just a cushion, isn't it? I don't know. In fact, we don't have the intuition our brains are even involved in vision. It's a revelation when you actually sort of go to school or read a book and you think, oh yeah, all these vast areas of the brain doing vision. I thought it was just the eyes. But because it isn't, it's all this enormously complicated calculation. But you have no idea about any of it. It's just, you know, what is that calculation? Of course, people who work on computer vision and understanding how the neuroscience of vision, they can tell you quite a lot about that. But we have no introspection about it at all. It's a complete blank. Well, I think that, and that's true generally. So if you pick up a cup or a deep play a tennis shot, huge amounts of perceptual motor stuff's going on. You're not really aware of any of it. Now, what you are aware of is the outputs of the system. So you're thinking, and that's at a very high level. So you're thinking, a cushion, or it's a red thing, or whatever. And that's the thing. That's the bit you're aware of. It's not the steps that your brain's going through. It's just the result. So it's like this complicated system thing. This huge neural network comes up with an answer. So, this is what I see, and that's. Yeah, that's kind of all you see, all you're consciously aware of. Now, it's another thing. So before I go back to your iceberg, this is still iceberg territory. Another thing that's interesting is that, and I talk about this a lot in the book, is that we have the illusion that those outputs, that conscious experience, is much richer than it is. So if I look around the room now, I'm still subject to this illusion. I think, well, yeah, there's objects everywhere. There's cushions and sofas and pictures on the wall, and there's lamps, and so I could just go on listing, and I have the feeling that I can see all those things and I'm conscious of them simultaneously. And that actually itself is an illusion. And there's some lovely examples and ways of showing that. But one of the most well known is a phenomenon called change blindness, where you just take an image, like a picture of an aircraft wing with various people wandering around on the ground, say. This is a particularly famous one. And then you switch it alternately with another image where something has changed. And the thing that's changed is the fact that the aircraft engine has just been edited out completely. Now, you would notice that if you just put those images back to back and alternate, you'll certainly think, oh, yeah, well, the aircraft engine pinging in and out of existence. But the only reason that's true is because when you make a change like that in an image, it creates a kind of disturbance. And the brain's very good at picking up, like, whoa, a change has occurred. Let me look at that. So some changes occurring in the visual world. So for example, it might be a moving rabbit if you're trying to catch a rabbit or something. We're very, very good at this change detection. In fact, almost every animal is. So you're very good at that change detection then. But as soon as you put something that messes that system up in the way. So for example, you interleave your two images with a mud splatter image. And there are millions of other ways of doing it. So you just have an image of a plane with engine. And this is massive, this engine. It's not small. Then you just have a little picture of, for example, what looks like little spots of mud on a window. That's very briefly, and then back goes to the next image. You just don't see anything. You can't notice this engine is gone unless you're looking at it at the time. So if you're searching the image and someone's saying, what's changing here? You kind of think, well, no, nothing really. Oh, hang on. I'm looking at the engine. I'm thinking engine now. I'm consciously aware of the engine at the moment. The engine's gone, and now, whoa. How did I miss that? So it's kind of extremely weird. And that's true quite generally. So if you look at a set of faces, like a school photograph, where those ones where we're all lined up on benches, you can have the feeling, oh, there's everybody, right? There's all these people. I can see like 100 people all at once. Obviously, you can't necessarily work out who's in which location. And so you have to look slowly. But you have the feeling that they're all visible to you. But actually, if you were to change the image so that only where your eye was looking at that given moment was the image well defined, and all the other faces were just blurred out, you wouldn't notice anything. As soon as I move my eye to a new spot, then then this can be done, of course, with eye trackers and sort of rapid adjustment of the image based on where your eye's moving. You just have to make sure that where you're looking, there's a face, everything else is blurred, and you just don't see anything. So we have this concept. So going back to icebergs, the first thing is the activity of the brain in general is enormously complicated, and we're no more aware of that than we are the activity of our body. And I've no more idea what's going on in my visual system, my visual cortex, than I have what's going on inside my heart. So like nothing, no idea. When it produces output and says, aha, hey presto, a thing, a cushion, or something you need to catch or whatever it is, then I can be aware of it. But then the other illusion is thinking I'm aware of all of this stuff simultaneously, but I'm not. I'm just aware of essentially one teeny little thing at a time. That's very weird, but it's true. And in fact, another thing to hammer that point home is just to note that it's one of these things that we all learn at school, but don't notice how weird it is. That if you look at the cells in the eye, we have two different kinds for detecting color and essentially just black and white. And the color cells are almost all in the fovea; they're always in the center of the eye. So roughly speaking, I'm looking directly at something, I can see it in color. And as soon as it moves far away from where I'm looking directly, my color vision is hopeless. And when it's in the periphery, so I'm looking at one thing, and we're asking, so I look at one book on my shelf and the question is, can I see the color of a book 10 degrees away? And the answer is, no, not really. I don't really see it at all because I haven't even got the cells. I haven't got the color sensitive cells. So it's not that it's some kind of subtle attentional problem. I haven't even got the detectors. And not only that, the precision of vision tapers off incredibly speedily as well. So the fovea is this area of the eye which you're continually moving around like a headlight or a searchlight. And that's where there's an incredibly densely packed set of cells. So you're really good at precisely rendering what you're seeing. For example, when you're reading, your fovea is hopping from letter to letter, so because you need that precision. But if you move very far away from the fovea, there's this incredibly rapid decline in visual precision. You really can't, you've got almost no idea what's going on, I'd say 5 or 10 degrees away from where you're looking. In this, it's a very large object. I mean, it's a really large letter, for example, in the periphery. That's okay. It has to be giant size. If it's small, it's just a blurry blob. So again, we have this feeling as we sort of look around the world, we have this feeling that everything's in sharp detail, full color, and we see everything at once. But actually, we've got a little searchlight, and the searchlight's hopping around. And where we're looking, yes, there's a little color and a little detail, but everything else is a bit blurry. And then we look somewhere else, and then, oh, the color's there. And so it's just this kind of weird illusion that we're looking around with a searchlight, but we think that the room is in full color all the time. It's like we think we're in a bright room where everything is visible, but actually, we've got this little tiny searchlight. But luckily, of course, we only care what's where the searchlight is, where the searchlight's pointing. So all the things that as soon as we start asking ourselves a question like, what's over there? Well, I think, well, I knew that one, didn't I? Because look, I can answer it. And the reason I can answer it is my searchlight just whizzed over to look. And once it's whizzed over, I give the answer. Anyway, so that's another icebergy thing. The final one, I will be brief with this, is that my feeling is that the only thing we're really aware of, even with this these outputs, is their sort of very sort of crude, so essentially their sensory qualities. So if you say to yourself, what are you conscious of when you hear someone speak? Say, you could say, are you conscious of the meaning? And my feeling would be that's really hard. I mean, there may be some sense in which that's true, but I think what you're really conscious of is you hearing the words. Here they come. They sound like this. And you might also find it conjures up those meanings, that those words conjure up some images in your mind. They might. They're again, sensory things. Do you think, oh yeah, I kind of had a weird sort of sense of the sea or calmness or something. There might be some sort of visual or auditory imagery going along, pretty shallow stuff usually. That's all the conscious stuff. But of course, for example, if you're reading a poem, you might have a sense of all kinds of complicated things going on inside you, and they will be, but what you're going to get generated is various snippets of imagery, awareness of the words. If you ask yourself, yes, but How am I interpreting it? What's the meaning of this poem? What's going on in my head? The answer is, well, I don't know. We'll have to start telling each other stories. But the stories won't be telling you what's really going on in your brain. The only thing, the consciousness is just unbelievably shallow. But incredibly important, of course. It's a tiny, tiny, tiny tip of a large iceberg, yes.
And that makes the argument for introspection being an illusion very strong, because if it's so kind of inaccurate in the moment, what's it going to be? How accurate is it going to be when you're looking back? But why are people so drawn to the idea of introspection and ruminating about the past and trying to construct it all together? And how can it actually set us free and improve our lives to kind of stop doing that and realize maybe the subconscious is an illusion and introspection isn't very helpful?
Yes. I think that's...
If you want to start your own podcast but have no idea where to start, and you want to generate viral social media clips and get your dream guests onto your show, even from just using your laptop in your bedroom like I did, then my Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint is exactly for you. It is a private paid course and community that has every single step and process I've used and continue to use to grow this show. And I include every single secret, every single tactic I do and still use that will get you results super fast. And also, if you want to access me personally every single week, then as part of this course, you'll also be able to join live weekly calls where I go through your podcast and answer your questions to get you results much, much faster. So if you want to actually start a podcast and stop dreaming and get millions of social media views and book your dream guests in half the amount of time it took me, then click the first link in the description. Let's get on to the rest of this episode.
A very interesting question. I think you're absolutely right that one of the things that is very unhelpful for most of us is this is excessive sort of ruminative introspection, particularly of an unproductive nature, and it often is. You just find yourself thinking the same thing round and round and round with slight variation. So like, why on earth did I do that? Oh, was it this? Was it that? Oh, it was this. And I'm hopeless. What was I doing? And round and round it goes. That almost invariably entirely futile activity. But even worse, if you think that you have the illusion that only if you think it through carefully can you sort of stop the problem happening again. If you think I made that mistake. So you go back to a sporting kind of example. If you'd have a double fault at a critical point, you might think, why? What was it that triggered that? Well, you said, A, you'll never get to the bottom of it. You're still trying to reconstruct the experience or watch yourself on replays or something. That's just completely hopeless. But of course, by endlessly ruminating about it and worrying about it, then you may well be compounding the problem. You're going to create a greater tendency to focus on the very things that have been unhelpful. So I think the freedom from the having the sense that there's this sort of mysterious unconscious forces that we can somehow have a good think about and get to grips with and sort out. The freedom from that vision is that we can think, no, actually, first of all, no one's, as it were, in control of their own brain. I mean, our brains are just running along doing the things they do and saying the things they say. And trying to think, you can step back and get to back to the sort of the inner planner and maybe the inner planner's secret agenda the funny things that led it to do the funny things it did and how we can fix it. That's just, kind of hopeless task. You're trying to sort of remodel remodel your own mind from through sheer force of will, and that's just hopeless task. It will never work. So it's a bit demoralizing to try and also just a waste of time and energy. But what we can, go on. So I think the alternative to that is that we absolutely can, I think, meaningfully think about how we are behaving and what we want to do and how we want to behave differently in the future. So I think really having a future perspective is the key. So it's pretty hopeless to say, why did I, say I muffed this tennis shot? Why did I, double faults or something? Why did I do that? No, that's not very helpful. But what is potentially helpful is thinking, I must practice my second serves, and I must practice them under pressure. So I'll try and create sort of fake pressure situations, and we'll try that. And actually using all kinds of imagery and imagination there can be really helpful. So a lot of sports psychologists, I think, will tell people is, imagine this is, this is championship point at Wimbledon. Imagine, so you've got to really go for it. This is your one chance to get the first serve in. Let's imagine that. Let's do that, 100 times. So when it really happens, it's like, here we are again. No big deal. And that, that's a sort of forward-looking strategizing about how to, as it were, train yourself for the future to behave in the way that you want to, rather than a kind of repair strategy where you think something must be broken. The subconscious is malfunctioning. Let me go in and try and work out what's wrong and then fix it. That's just not the right strategy. And going back to something like ChatGPT or neural networks in general, the way to, when they do weird stuff, which obviously, especially when they're being trained, they clearly do a lot, the answer to fixing them is just to train them, is to give them feedback about what they're doing wrong and try and get them to learn it better. So you have all these users who are saying, looking at ChatGPT answers, saying that's a bad answer. Well, that's a good answer. There's a huge amount of human training going on, which is sculpting a system to say sensible thing. But nobody, it's not like a conventional computer program where it's going wrong and then the person who wrote it is thinking, oh no, there's clearly some bug. Where's the bug? And that's going to be the feeling we have, I think, about how ourselves, perhaps the people's intuition about the subconscious, or the general idea that our mind is this explicit calculating machine. It's more like, so when something goes wrong, we think, there's a bug in the code, or there's a break in the machinery. I've just got to go and find, I've got to understand what it was, I can fix it. Whereas if you're dealing with something like a neural network, like ChatGPT, or indeed our brains, that's not the right way to go. You've just got to think, okay, train out the problem. Let's figure out how to do better. And it's a complex system which will, it'll find a way to solve it. You'll never know why it happened. And if you did know, it would be lost in the mad space of this vast sea of interconnected neurons. You wouldn't be able to think, oh, it was this time, it was my belief that such and such, or my fear of something or other. It's not going to look like that. It's just going to be this big tangle. So don't even try.
And how does that relate to kind of habits and setting new habits? Yeah. And I don't know if it was Socrates or Seneca that said, we are what we repeatedly do. How does kind of enforcing new and good habits maybe be more beneficial than sitting in our bed introspecting about why we're failing and how we can improve?
Yeah. I think that's the habits are one very interesting way to go. Definitely. Yeah. You want to do things differently and better than you're training your brain by doing stuff and doing stuff potentially in different ways. So you might think, I must be more thoughtful or attentive, or I must remember to focus when I'm talking to somebody rather than just drift off to my own thoughts or whatever. But you can give yourself little clues and hints. So you're a bit like a trainer. But just as the trainer can't look inside the brain of the person they're training, neither can you. We don't know what's going on inside our brain. And you might think, well, hang on, it's my brain. Surely I know what's going on. And I think that's the illusion, right? I know no more. I mean, literally know no more about the operation of my brain than I do about yours. Of course I don't. I haven't got a clue what's going on. Even as I'm speaking, I have no idea about any of it. And that's okay. But I can. One thing I can train my brain, and I can't train yours, because I can. I can say, okay, I will read that book I always thought I should read, or I will, practice my tennis or whatever it may be. So having this sort of forward-looking perspective, I think is really the key. Yeah. And of course, I think another thing that connects to is thinking about the value of talking to people, indeed also to therapy. So sometimes when I talk to people about this kind of perspective, they think, oh, so does that mean that I'm telling them that therapy is useless? And they often would say, but it patently isn't. Yes, it really helped me or whatever. And I think that's absolutely not the case. I think actually helping us think about think about the story of our lives and how they've gone in the past and how do we want to go forward. That's really important. And I think that's the kind of thing that therapy can do for you. I know, I'm also not saying you should never look backwards. But creating those stories is incredibly important to making our lives meaningful. And when those stories seem to be broken, so you know, something awful happens, you feel this, or somebody behaves in a way you can't understand, and you feel like, I don't have a story anymore, my story is, you know, a kind of dark one, and I need to find some way to cope with this. And that's really difficult. And we have to, you know, there's no magic solutions. And as humans discussing with each other, therapists, but also just, you know, each other, that's just really one of the main mechanisms we have to deal with these things. And it does help a lot. But what the illusion is thinking, now we've had a good think about what happened in the divorce or whatever it is, then that I've got to the truth of it. I now know, you know, what was going on. I was thinking this and she was thinking that. And I mean, that's the wrong perspective. That it's more like one should be thinking, I'm creating a story like you have a story for a nation or a company or a sports team. You know, what is our vision for, you know, who we are, where we've come from, what we're trying to do? You can't think of that as that, you know, when you're creating that thing, you're creating your own mythology. Not that myths are useless or nonsense. It's just that you shouldn't be thinking, yeah, but, you know, can we really verify it? Because you certainly can't. Because to do that would be to imagine you can go inside the brains of all those people in your past and understand the complex machines that they are, which you can't and never could do.
And if our brain stitches fragments together on the fly and we're constantly improvising, what does this mean for taking experts' advice on things?
Well, I think, yes, I mean, humans are these amazing improvisers. I think that's the thing we all should remember. And I think for anyone who feels a tendency towards imposter syndrome, I think one reason that we have this feeling is that we think that it's just us improvising. So, you know, you order it, one wanders into a situation by itself, and you're thinking, oh, I don't really know what's going on here. And then people sort of get you to do things and ask you questions. And you kind of blunder along and you think, well, I kind of got away with it this time. That sense of just skating on thin ice, just getting from one question to another or one task to another, thinking, right, okay, seem to work. Everyone else, they all seem fine. They all know what they're doing. They have the deep knowledge and the detailed plans, and they're just implementing a fully worked out method, whereas I'm just blundering along. And I think the first thing is that we're all blundering and we're all improvising. And that, I should say, I think that's the secret of human intelligence. So rather than thinking this improvisational blundering is a kind of sign of problem or failing, I think what it's actually telling you is that the human brain is coping with a really rich and complicated and unpredictable world. And it's amazingly well able to do it, right? The fact that we can cope at all with such a world which is far too complicated for us to properly model, it's kind of it's remarkable. And the way we do it is by improvisation, and how clever we are at improvising, it's amazing. Anyway, so quickly on imposters, the fact that we all feel imposters is, I think, we should all think it's the normal state of affairs. We're all blundering along. We all feel a bit like imposters, and shouldn't really, because we're no more imposters than anybody else. Now, then one might think, well, what about, you know, are there real experts who, you know, really know things that we in some sort of profound way that we don't? And I think the answer to that is that it's not that the experts, whether experts, have some kind of knowledge locked away in their brains that's somehow special. That's again a wrong way to see thinking. But it is true, of course, that in particular domains, particular topics, there are people who know how to do things that we can't do, and make judgments and calculations and so on that we can't make ourselves. And we should always be skeptical. We should always be wondering, well, you know, is this person really an expert, or are they really in the domain they're expert in? I mean, for example, in something like psychology, which is my primary discipline, certainly I don't think I'm myself an expert on the mind or brain, because it's a total mystery to me. I mean, and everybody. I mean, you know, we have little tiny glimmers of understanding what's going on in corners here and there. But, you know, overall, the operation of the brain, even in general terms, is pretty baffling. If you had said, here's somebody who ostensibly looks like they must be an expert because they've been studying this for nearly 40 years, they must know something by now. And I think, do know something. But you'd be wrong to think, ask me a question about the mind, I will have a really solid definitive answer. I think we should always be sort of querying and questioning and thinking experts don't have any special powers. Which isn't to say, of course, that human progress does work by distribution of resources. I mean, we're not all trying to solve the same problem. So the people are trying to do medical research and trying to figure out how the climate works and do particle physics and play tennis and all of these things. I mean, there's like a myriad of incredibly challenging, difficult things that humans are able to do. So I do defer. We all defer to other people all the time, but it's not because they've got some special hidden stuff tucked away in their brains. And in fact, just a final aside on that is one thing that I think is very interesting working with mathematicians, which I do a little, is I tend to think, I mean, I did maths a bit at university, but not for very long, and I realized I was not going to be a top mathematician pretty quickly. But I tend to think that the people who are really good at maths, they just have all this stuff locked away, vast quantities of maths, which is just completely at their fingertips. And I think, again, it's completely the wrong perspective, actually. So even the very best mathematicians are, and maybe there are some exceptions, but the ones I know who really are quite well-known mathematicians, that would be saying, oh, I never understood this. Oh, yeah, I have to think this through again. Oh, hang on, is it a plus or a minus in this equation? Oh, God, I don't know. And they're still sort of floundering around like the rest of us. Now, of course, they're floundering in a way that in an area, and floundering directly in a way that frankly goes in the right direction, in an area which we can't penetrate. Right? And they'll end up with all the right equations and all the right answers. No, but the bits there that they're engaged in the things they're doing that are beyond us. But the floundering nature of the process and the feeling of, oh, I never quite understand this, it's a bit of a model, and having to continue having to look things up and do a little calculation, that's just like we're doing when we're doing everything else. So I think, everybody's brain is works roughly the same way, really. We just have to spend our time doing different things.
Yeah, and the idea that even the experts and the geniuses are floundering, does that mean we should probably just flounder at something we enjoy because we're going to stick with it for longer periods of time?
I do think picking your topic for floundering is really important. Yeah, I think that's right, actually. I think it sounds a bit loopy, really, but my general experience in research is that I spend a very large amount of time feeling confused and very rarely think, oh, I suddenly understand something I didn't before. I mean, there are some things which are quite simple to understand and someone else has figured them out. So you think, I kind of got that, okay. But then if it's something you're trying to figure out which isn't clear, or indeed someone's figured it out but you can't understand what they've done, then there's a lot of floundering going on. And of course, the floundering is enjoying floundering, I think, is a really important thing because that's where you're going to make progress. You're going to learn. You're going to see. You don't understand it now, but if you flounder for a bit, you will. If you find yourself, if you think, oh, floundering, this is a bit unpleasant, I must be doing the wrong thing, or I must be a bit silly, I'll stop floundering, I'll just do something else, then you don't have the opportunity to learn and develop interesting new things. And I suspect that's true in any activity, but probably many activities. I suspect in lots of the arts, people spend a lot of time thinking, I'm trying to do some new thing, don't really know how to do it, I'm floundering about. And people starting businesses. I mean, in some ways, if a business already exists, you're trying to open one more McDonald's or Tesco, then there's not too much floundering because it's been done so many times and everyone knows how to do it. They kind of do it. Still, things will go awry, but basically you know what you're doing. But all those sort of new enterprises that are springing up, all the people setting those up are all floundering around. And in some ways, the fact that they're floundering is a sign that you're in a space which is ill-defined and confusing, but also potentially exciting. So I think living happily with the sense that, we're confused and floundering beings, and the sense that you're just improvising your way from one half-understood thing to the next is okay. And in fact, that's sort of normal. And that we shouldn't put one off, at least.
Yeah.
Pressing forwards.
Yeah. And if you're floundering, I guess it means you're on the edge of your capabilities in a way. And then that's why we get imposter syndrome. So instead of kind of feeling guilty about imposter syndrome or being upset about it, it shows we're pushing ourselves and going to improve ourselves in the long term, even though it might not feel like it or be enjoyable in the moment, right?
No, I think that's dead right. Yeah. Being on the edge of your capabilities as you push it, I think that's exactly right. Because that's where you're going to learn the most. There's no point trying to do things that are just way too difficult for us. There's no point opening the quantum gravity book halfway through and thinking, okay, let's really go for it. That's going to be useless. But on the other hand, and similarly, having a set of tennis with Djokovic is not going to be very helpful either. It improved my tennis.
I've read that you defined grief as a breakdown in one's understanding of life.
I don't recall doing that, but it sounds a pretty reasonable definition. I mean, I think at least that there's probably other things that would be encompassed within the breakdown of one's understanding of life. But I think the sense that one's life ceases to make sense, I think that's incredibly difficult. And things like, losing a person in your life, or some relationship breakdown, or indeed sometimes cataclysmics of career disasters, these can leave people feeling that their life makes no sense anymore. They don't know how to make sense. They had a vision, they had a story about what their life was, and it's kind of doesn't seem to be the right story. They can't see how that story could go forwards. And I think so then it's a massive sort of job to try and reconstruct a new story. And not just any old crazy story. It's got to be a story that makes sense. You've got to sort of believe in it, and not believe in that it's the ultimate truth, but you have to feel, okay, yeah, I can sort of authentically identify with the new vision of myself. I think it is, but I do think it's something that can only happen slowly. That process of reconfiguring your sort of understanding of the world is a very slow one. But I do think that this perspective has some connection with the fact that when something's very unexpected or very shocking, so if somebody close to you dies when they're quite young, and it's just you never know when they're expected to happen, that's obviously a devastating thing. And one of the reasons it's so devastating compared to someone who's lived a long life and dies at 90 is that you kind of, in the latter case, you kind of know what the story is. You've had a sense of, oh, this person's been in my life and they're very important to me, but of course they've had a good life, but it's finite and forever, and sort of predictably their life ends, which is still very sad, but it's not this kind of blowing up of your expectations about reality. And I think one of the things that we really struggle with, and it's just the innate part of the human condition, really, is we want to have a story which both seems sensible to us, but also which is a good story. So we don't want to have a story in which we think, just horrible random stuff happens all over the place, and it's going to happen to me. More is going to happen. Everything's going to fall apart. You don't want that story. But obviously, you also need a story which is authentic. So trying to somehow refashion an understanding of the world which can be positive, even though some terrible, terrible unexpected thing has happened, is just a long and painful process. There's no shortcuts, unfortunately.
And should we almost try not to overscript our lives in the future? The Stoics say we should only control how we react to things, and there's a lot of things that aren't in our control. Is it better to make the script of our lives very narrow, like with the headlights on, like the way we see?
Yes, I think in many ways that's right, actually. I mean, certainly the more you try to fill in the details of your script for the future, then the more you're inevitably going to have to be disappointed and adjust and so on. So the sense of, I remember meeting someone who was slightly, this is many, many, so 30 years ago or something. So, well, of course, ultimately, I've got to go from this string of failed relationships to a solid wife, two kids, dog, and small house outside London. Obviously, it was bizarre. It obviously tapped into some kind of really well-developed sense of this is what a life is supposed to be. He was also thinking, I don't seem to be going anywhere near that. It's like one disaster after another. But that, I think that is probably an error to think, this is a vision for what my life should be, whatever specific vision you want. It's probably better to be unspecific, because actually, first of all, you can't control what your life will be. And second of all, it's really hard to know what you actually want. So it's a real illusion. I mean, because of the old, mysterious workings of the mind, we don't really know what's going to be the best possible life for us or the future we want. So you're kind of groping from moment to moment and step one step at a time. So it's much better to think, things can go in a variety of directions. Well, let's try this one. Maybe there's one. There's lots of possibilities. There are probably many of them good. There'll be some bad ones too. And all you're really trying to achieve is to have a good one. To go down a good track, it'll be bad. It'll be up and down. But you want your overall to think, okay, life worked out in a kind of good way overall, rather than it all went physically wrong. But if you're aiming for a narrow target, then that makes that process seem rather unlikely to succeed. And indeed, I think there's no point focusing too much on things that are outside of your control. That's just a way to torment yourself pointlessly.
Yeah. And in 2020, I found a video on YouTube about you talking about AI and AGI and ASI and the singularity. And your view was quite, I wouldn't say contrarian, but it was less kind of optimistic, or maybe less... I guess techno-optimistic, in the sense that don't you think that ASI and the singularity is very far into the future and we're being over-optimistic?
Well, yeah. So I think I may be changing my perspective on this. So I started off feeling that the singularity is a long, long way away. If you went back, say, 10 years, I remember having a chat with one of the big people in AI who was talking a lot about the singularity, and Sir Stuart Russell. And he's a very, very, very major, very important computer scientist, and has deep thinking around these things. And I remember thinking, I'm just really mystified, Stuart, that you're so worried about this. I mean, we're so far away, aren't we? And he wasn't saying, well, we're not far away because of the X, Y, or Z. He was just saying, well, look, we're going to hit this problem at some point. When we do, we really need to be ready for it. So, which I think is a pretty powerful argument, actually. But I was personally thinking, somebody in the next century or two has to worry about this, but not now. But I think I've been astounded by what's happened in generative AI. And to be honest, I think almost everybody has, possibly except for some insiders. But even the insiders, I don't think they really, because it's such a mystery. I mean, you take these systems, you scale them up, give them more data, make them bigger and bigger, and you don't really know what's going to happen. Why do transformer networks work? I don't know. And I don't think anyone really knows why do these various tricks put together suddenly lead to this kind of astonishing step change and sort of series of step changes in the sophistication of these systems. It's amazing. I mean, I'm genuinely astonished by it. So I'm still not thinking the singularity is around the corner, but then again, I'm much, much less confident in my subjective belief in confidence in my assessments on these things has collapsed because it's just been, it's ridiculous what these things can do now. I think we should really have to worry about this, actually. I think it's a serious issue.
What could be the implications? And I also really respect how you've not necessarily fully changed your mind, but being aware it has changed. Like a lot of people will try and deny it or stick to their guns. It's like, it's a wise thing to do and a very respectable thing to do, because a lot of people don't change their mind on things or alter their opinions and say, look, this is different. But I don't think, like you said, anyone was expecting it to compound this rapidly, which makes me kind of wonder, like, you think it's still quite wild to the singularity, but what are some of the implications if the singularity happens in the near future and we're not prepared for it?
I think you're quite right. We don't have any idea really now. There's kind of exponential sort of build up potentially could mean that we just find ourselves racing to the singularity before we know it. And particularly, obviously, the kind of people think about the possibility of systems to start to design the future generation of smarter systems. And once that happens, that is when you've got the singularity, I guess. But you don't quite know where that point is. You can get a human / automated. You can have humans and AI systems trying to design together the next generation of AI systems. And at some point, they may just generate a system which doesn't need any help now. It can just create very, very, very quickly indeed, possibly, cleverer and cleverer systems. And then then kind of Pandora's box is open. I don't know. I think this is a serious existential problem for humanity. I'm hopeful we can fix it or get a work around it, but we should be deeply worried. It's a bit like the period when we were creating the atomic bomb. There was obviously a very powerful reason to do that, but it's something where you think, well, this is really creating a threat to human existence, which didn't exist before. We have no idea how big this threat is, but it could be pretty huge. So I'm not as sanguine as I used to be. No.
Yeah. And isn't the difference between creating the nuclear bomb and creating artificial superintelligence is when you create the nuclear bomb, you can kind of reverse it and not use it. Whereas with artificial superintelligence, it's almost like a runaway effect.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's once the superintelligence is out there, it may be very hard to control. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have control over the actual physical stuff quickly. This isn't necessarily all that reassuring. But as it were, if you've got a sort of artificial superintelligence in a box, it can't actually control anything, then that's kind of one thing. The trouble is, if it's that clever, it's pretty soon going to be finding ways to get us to persuade it to do things which we think are completely innocent, which aren't completely innocent. Then we're giving it control of the Internet of Things, and then it'll have everything it wants. So I don't think we have no idea. I mean, okay, parallel would be with what happens if we, or what should we do about advertising the existence of humanity to alien civilizations on other planets? And my feeling would be never, under any circumstances, ever advertise the existence of human existence to anybody. I mean, idiotically, I think, not done that in the past. Because actually, if any alien intelligence is smart enough to get here, we're in deep trouble. We probably hit the AIs of their own future, actually. That's totally crazy. Like, you just have no idea what risk you're launching yourself into. So I think it's one of those situations where there's no point trying to think it through in detail. All we know is we're walking into a world inadvertently where we have no idea what the rules are and what's possible and what isn't possible. And as you say, we can't reverse it.
But also it can be incredibly positive as well, it could completely revolutionize ourselves, our lives, our society. Yep. And yep. It's just the sky is, a space is the limit with this, really. But then what's the drawbacks, you know? It kind of goes against the basic Darwinian principle of the most intelligent species is normally the top of the food chain.
Yes. Yes, we don't. I would certainly, if you were a chimp or a gorilla thinking, are humans going to be a problem? But I think they're going to be fine. There's not that many of them. They don't seem terribly threatening. They seem quite smart. That you'd be wrong to be relaxed. Yeah.
Is it almost, it's a bit more philosophical, but why again, like we say, we shouldn't really be introspecting and stuff in the subconscious mind, etc. But why are we trying to make something so much smarter than us? Are we trying to almost create our own God? It's just,
I don't know. I mean, the motivations are very different for different people. But so I know some of the people. I mean, so Jeff Hinton, I've known for years, and he's probably as much involved as anybody. And I think, Jeff's somebody who just wants to understand how the brain works and to make smart AI. And he's incredibly dedicated, thoughtful person who's been thinking deeply about how brains operate for many decades. And it's just a natural sort of step forward to think, well, we've got this far, let's keep going, let's see what we can do. And of course has produced some spectacular advances, which I think will give us deep understanding of what brains are doing, actually. I think it's completely wrong to think, but this is some kind of artificial thing, which is nothing like a how human intelligence works. I think this is the best model. It's not going to be just how we think, but it's the best model we have of the kind of computational machinery a brain consists of. And it was modeled on that. That's not accidental. The people who invented neural networks were looking at brains and think, well, how do these work? So I think there's a kind of pure science, pure engineering drive. It's just, you know, people and just want to understand things, want to make things work better. But of course, a side effect of that, when you've got this far, is that we may be, you know, changing things, our own position in the universe in a fundamental way. I mean, I am somewhat hopeful. I'm not despairing here. I just feel we're just entering a world of a new risk we don't understand. But I'm also, very positive about some of the things AI can do for us, and also positive about the continuing need for humans. I think human brain is still pretty amazing and very specific. So for humans, though, it's not that, and smartness is very varied too. So it's not that humans are smarter than, think about any animal you like, some leopards at leaping or cormorants at diving into the sea or something. I mean, the animal kingdom has this vast range of very sophisticated intelligent behavior, or just sophisticated behavior, which requires lots of control with very complex neural systems, and we can't do any of that. But we're really good at certain kinds of general purpose thinking, and so I guess it'll be the case that AI systems won't be necessarily able to do all the things we can do, or even be very interested in doing them. Why should they? Why should we make them? But so I'm still hopeful that human uniqueness will still matter and be important, just in the same way that the biological world is, the enormous variety of the biological world is still of value and importance, even if you've got humans on the planet. In fact, very much so. But all of these things are very, very, very hard to speculate about. Although clearly we should be thinking about this question.
Definitely. And just quickly, what do you think about kind of the idea of, if you can't beat ASI and superintelligence, join them, and the idea of Neuralink and other brain machine interfaces?
I'm pretty skeptical about this, actually. And the brain has developed its own Neuralinks, as it were, with the body and the sense organs, and they are really well developed. So if you want to get information in and out of my brain, I've already got these massive sensory processing systems. And similarly, for generating, getting information out of my brain, you've already got human speech and gesture and so on. So you've got all this is wired in. This is the very fabric of the brain. So I think the idea that one thing that you could do with a Neuralinky type of method is use individual human brains more efficiently. I suspect that's wrong, because it goes back in a way to the very idea that inside the brain, there's this kind of the planet with all these deep thoughts and beliefs and values and things that you could somehow pick out. So if you believe that there was this kind of repository of knowledge and goals and so in my head, then your Neuralinky type system could connect me with an AI. The AI could think, oh, that's what you want to know. You know all this stuff, and these are your objectives. I'll go and help you with those, and I'll go and tell you the answer and pop them back in your brain. But I think that's totally the wrong perspective in the first place. In fact, we don't have any of that. All I'm doing is improvising moment to moment. It's not the case that you could take all my other objectives and tasks and go off and solve them and help me solve. And in fact, if I'm halfway through thinking about something, the idea that an external system could take that thought, flip it back, answer the question and help me with it, as it were, mid-thought, I think that's also a fantasy, really. I think the very way the brain operates is quite slowly. It operates in a way that's totally dark to us. We don't know what it's doing. But it does generate these little snippets of thinking. So I could generate some words, and then I stop for a bit, ponder, and maybe you generate some words, I generate some words. If that's the way our reflection and thought proceeds, trying to circumvent that, I think, will be completely impossible, really. So I don't think there's going to be a human hybrid AI hybrid, which will be of any particular interest. He's just trying to hybridize, he's trying to put together things which just the way the machinery works just doesn't mesh, I think. So I think that will go nowhere, but I've been wrong before. You never know.
Nick Chater, ladies and gentlemen, Nick, really appreciate your time. And I think this conversation is very beneficial for people who maybe introspect and ruminate too much and want to, you know, crack on with their lives. And that certainly has been me in the past. So reading your book and having this conversation, it's been really beneficial to me. And I hope the audience enjoyed it as much as I did. Where can people go if they want to find your work?
Well, there's the Mind is Flat. Of course, it's available on Amazon or anywhere else. The Language Game with my friend Morten Christensen is my other popular book on the emergence of language. And I have an exciting new book, but this is not yet out, coming out in early 2026, called It's On You with George Lerbenstein, who's quite a well-known behavioral economist, looking at the implications of what we know about behavioral science for how we run governments and how we generate public policies. That's a different world, but that's coming too.
Well, yeah, when it's released, I'd love to do round two and talk about it in 2026.
I'd be delighted.
Got to the end of this video, then you're literally in the top 1% of minds on the planet. You're curious, you love podcasts, and you love this show, but you also probably want to start your own show as well. And this is the exact same position I was in about a year or two ago, where I consumed so many podcasts and loved every second of it. But in the back of my mind, there was always that thought, I want to start my own show. But the problem was all these podcasters that I listened to didn't have a step-by-step blueprint that would help me avoid the mistakes that they've made and create my own pro show like the ones that I listened to from them in a fast amount of time. Luckily for you, I've solved this problem for you. I've created my step-by-step pro remote podcast blueprint for the kind of person who wants to start a podcast from scratch but has no idea of what equipment to use, how to find guests, how to actually record it even on their laptop if they live in the middle of nowhere and don't have a studio, which, let's be real, most of you probably don't have and you don't actually need, and want to grow their show fast, generate viral social media clips, and actually turn podcasting into not just a dream, but a genuine career that they can make money from. So if you're interested in this, it is literally a video course that goes through every single step and process that'll get you from no idea of how to start a show, no idea how podcasting works, to a pro remote podcaster who has the potential to generate viral social media clips and get their dream guests on their show in a matter of weeks. And as well as the video course, you'll also be able to join live weekly calls with me, where I'll go through your show and give you personalized feedback of how to improve to get you results much faster. You'll also get access to the AI email templates, the AI research templates, the title and thumbnail templates I use to get super high personality guests, super high performing guests, and at a really, really good conversion rate. A lot of the emails I send do end up getting yeses for people coming onto the show, as well as generate super engaging thumbnails and titles, and also generate viral social media clips. For example, one of my social media clips got 1 million+ views on Instagram and TikTok, the same clip. So this is proof that it works. And if you want to get all of this and genuinely become a pro podcaster super fast, even from your bedroom, then this is for you. And alongside my templates, you'll also get an ebook, which goes into even more detail about not just my show and how to create your own pro show, but also other successful shows and the tactics that they do to blow up on social media and generate a loyal audience that they can actually teach, but also make a career from as well. So if you're interested, then it's the first link in the description. You won't regret it. I know you've been dreaming of creating a podcast your entire life, or for at least a year. 6 months, and this is the best opportunity you're going to get. And I don't know any other pro podcaster that I listen to, that I love, that has a step-by-step blueprint of the exact things they do to grow and continue to succeed at their show. So this is the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for you right now. It might have changed if you're watching this a few months later, but right now you can get the founder's pre-sale price. And basically, once 25 members join the community, the price will double. And also, if you don't feel satisfied with the course and with the community, and you have followed all the steps, taken all the notes, taken all the action, and if you don't feel like you're at least 5 times more confident at podcasting and don't have a remote pro show all set up and ready to get your dream guests on to your show and create a super awesome podcast, then I'll give you your money back, no questions asked. So if you're interested, first link in the description, your future self will thank you. I'll hopefully see you there. Goodbye.